The 1994 Salt Lake Sandstone Symposium presents session number 375, an interview, Confessions of a Pious Heretic, a conversation with Sterling M. McMurrin. Interviewer, Laurie DiPadova.
Live coverage of the Salt Lake Sandstone Symposium. We're about to bring you the final broadcast in this year's edition of the Sandstone Symposium, one of the most popular sessions in the 1993 symposium of last year. Was an interview with Sterling M. McMurrin, a well-known Mormon theologian and authors of books such as The Philosophical Foundations of Mormon Theology and Religion, Reason, and Truth, Historical Essays in the Philosophy of Religion. He will be interviewed this year by Laurie DiPadova, who is a PhD candidate in Organizational Behavior at Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy, State University of New York at Albany, and who is also presented papers here at this year's Sunstone Symposium, and also a personal friend of Sterling McMurrin's, and so she'll be able to probe and push Sterling McMurrin into saying things that he might not otherwise say. They will be just sitting down a minute and getting ready to start our interview. And we'll go now to Laurie DiPadova, who will introduce Sterling McMurrin.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Laurie DiPadova, and it is my pleasure indeed to welcome you to this session of Sunstone, which is an interview with Sterling McMurrin. As you know, last year Jack Newell interviewed him, and that was a wonderful interview. Now, if y'all weren't here or don't have the tape, I hope Albert still has copies, because it is a fantastic interview. And in Jack's absence this year, I'm pleased to be able to talk with Sterling. Let me just say that Jack and Sterling are doing a book called Conversations with Sterling McMurrin, which is based on a series of interviews that Jack has done with Sterling, and is a wonderful book. I want to commend that. Now, as everyone always says to a group like this, Sterling McMurrin needs no introduction. Everyone knows about you being in John Kennedy's administration. They know about your church work and teaching teaching in the church. They know
what church work was that?
Oh, come on. They know about your writings, your distinguished service to the University of Utah. Jack described you as a loving critic of the church, but I'd like to also say, from what I've observed, you are the most ardent defender of Mormonism I've ever seen, an ardent defender of the church and of Mormons. And I'd like to just surface something that y'all undoubtedly know, that Sterling McMurrin is a real treasure to the church and a real treasure to all of us. He and his family, his wife Natalie, they're warm and gracious and generous in every way. And Sterling I met him when I was a new convert years ago, and just amazing people just embody the very best of Mormonism. And the best of humanity, indeed. So I was interested, Sterling, in your the title of the interview. You told Albert that you wanted it titled Confessions of a Pious Heretic. Would you mind telling us what you mean by that, what you mean by being a heretic, and how that's different from being an apostate?
Don't you have a wonderful Southern accent? It's great. I remember in a high priest class, I think I went about once every 6 months, and the secretary said to me, Brother McMurrin, I always mark you as absent for other church work. I asked him what church work he had in mind. Well, he wasn't sure, but surely I was out doing some church work. I was just home asleep. It's rather important, I think, to recognize in response to Laurie's question, that there's a basic difference between a heretic and an apostate. It's a little like the case, I think, of the woman who was upbraiding a panhandler who was somewhat inebriated, and she said she wasn't going to give money to an alcoholic. And he said, "Lady, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm just a plain old drunk." Well, she said, "What's the difference between an alcoholic and a drunk?" We said, "Lady, there's a lot of difference. There's a lot of difference. Us drunks don't have to go to them damn meetings." Now, that's the case with us heretics. Us heretics don't have to go to them trials along with you apostates. At least we're not supposed to. I was talking with President Brown some years ago when he was in the first presidency about a friend who was up for excommunication, and I said, "Now, President Brown, he's a heretic. He's not an apostate. He's a heretic. And we do not," I was lying here, of course, I said, "we do not excommunicate heretics. We excommunicate apostates, not heretics." He said, "I hope not, because I'm one." He was a great one, too.
Well, Sterling, what would you say a heretic is, then?
I mean, well, a heretic is a person who doesn't believe. He's a heretic at certain points, or at all points, for that matter. I'm quite a thoroughgoing heretic. I can name a lot of points at which I'm a disbeliever. An apostate is a person who turns against the church. Heretics don't necessarily turn against the church. Apostates turn against the church. Now, I'm a pious heretic, as you mentioned. You see, somewhere in the scripture, or Joseph Smith or somebody said, there must needs be opposition in all things. Well, there must needs be opposition among heretics. There are good heretics and bad heretics. There are good apostates and bad apostates. Now, I'm a good apostate. I'm a good as you were. I'm a good heretic. Good heretics aren't really mad at the church. They just don't like some of the things that it teaches and some of the things that go on. Well, they're not mad at the church. Now, bad heretics are mad at the church. And there are bad heretics. But that's all right. I have no objection to them. Now, there are good apostates and bad apostates. I could name some bad apostates, but I'll name some good apostates, the Tanners. That is Sandra and what's his name?
Gerald.
Sandra and Gerald Tanner are good apostates. They're against the church, but they're honest and decent. And not only that, they're very competent. But there are apostates that are dishonest and are not decent. Now, that's quite a different type.
Okay.
So I think when you talk about heretics and apostates, you have to distinguish between them. And then recognize that there's no point in getting upset over the fact that some people are heretics, some people may be apostates. That's just the way the world is.
Well, now, Sterling, as you know, a number of intellectuals and people who think differently have been excommunicated in the past year. You have not been excommunicated.
And
yet you describe yourself as a heretic, a thorough heretic. Why do you think you've never been excommunicated?
Well, I'm just not an intellectual. It's them damn intellectuals that get into trouble, you know. Most of them are historians. They have the crazy notion that they ought to tell the truth about church history. And that gets them into trouble. But when you say, lots of people say to me, why haven't you been excommunicated? Well, I just have to say it's a little like the social worker that was interviewing a prostitute in Reno. And she said to her, how come a fine, upstanding young woman like you from one of Boston's first families with plenty of money and a fine education at Vassar College, how come you would end up as a prostitute in Reno? And she said, well, I don't know, I'm just lucky, I guess. Well, that's the way with me, and just lucky, I guess. But you know, excommunication is partly a function of geography. It depends on where you live. Now, of course, some of them are engineered from 47 East South Temple, and it doesn't matter much where you live. But insofar as they're engineered by the local authorities, they're the ones that are supposed to do it. Why, it just depends on where you live. Now, I live in the only true ward in the church. It's a wonderful ward. The people are decent, and I go to church regularly, at least once a year, mainly to dinners, high priest dinners. They're wonderful. But it depends in part on the kind of people that you're thrown in with. Some of these people, unfortunately, are thrown in stakes where there are, wards and stakes that have younger people are the worst to be in. These younger people who are just home from missions and so on, they can be terribly bigoted. I mean this quite seriously. The wards that have older people in them, or where the older people are more dominant, or the stakes where older people are more dominant, I think are the ones where you'll find the most genuine liberality and decency in matters of this kind. Years ago, I was on the Stake High Council of Southern Arizona Stake, and the very first meeting that I went to of the High Council, one of the members of the council said, the stake president was a man connected with the University of Arizona and a person of some stature. And one of the people on the High Council said, now what are we going to do about, what's his name, I forget the name, about having that excommunication trial for him? And the stake president, whose name was Orlando Ballantyne, some of you may have known him, said, no, I don't want to hear any more about that. There's not going to be anyone excommunicated in this stake as long as I'm stake president. Well, you know, you'll find people like that. And then you'll find others who are just looking around to find somebody that they can put the bee on and get them excommunicated. And that's very unfortunate, because the question of justice in the church, you see, is very, very uneven. Very uneven. There's no reason in the world why some of these people, like this young man Wright at Brandeis, a Middle Eastern scholar who was recently excommunicated. I read his statement and the stake president's statement to him. No reason in the world why he should be excommunicated, and guys like me should not be. That doesn't make any sense at all. This man is much more of a believer, if one can take what he wrote, and I'm sure you can, is far more of a believer than I am. That doesn't make a bit of sense. It's not a bit of justice for him to be excommunicated. And for people like me, and a lot of people like you, are left in the church. It's wrong. It shouldn't be done that way. I mean, they ought to get all of us or none of us.
Well, now, Sterling, as you know, with geography and this question of justice and all, this is a very painful time.
Of course it is.
A lot of our good friends excommunicated, people we look up to and respect and admire, excommunicated for reasons that seem very bogus, frankly. What advice do you have for us in handling these sorts of things?
Well, I don't know that you can do very much about it. Now, you know, I was invited. There have been a couple of petitions printed in the Tribune. With many signatories, I was invited to sign each of those. I didn't sign them. For one thing, I didn't like the way they were written, but that's beside the point. I have plenty of sympathy and don't disapprove of other people signing them, but I've been in a kind of a hassle with the church for over 50 years. And I just prefer to go it alone. And I don't think a lot of these petitions and love marches and so on do a bit of good. The general authorities are not affected by that. They are affected by some things, but they're not affected, in my opinion, by these petitions. Now, I think, actually, if 50 first-rate people at the BYU would stand up the way they ought to and say, by damn, this sort of thing down here has got to stop, or we'll all walk out, that might do some good. You know, the University of Utah in 1915... had the biggest hassle in its history. It wasn't a very large institution in 1915, but about 17 people on the faculty did walk out, and it produced a reform in the University of Utah. And the net result was, though it took a little time, the net result was that the church took its hands off the University of Utah, though it took a little time. But it was these people walking out in 1915 that made the difference. I am frankly of the opinion that there would be far more freedom of thought and expression in the church if the people would simply take it. That there would be far more intellectual freedom at the BYU if the people down there, more of them had the courage to be free. It takes a certain amount of courage to be free and stand up against the tide. And there aren't enough of them down there doing it. There are some. Martha Bradley, an example, she walked out. She said, hell with it. Well, I don't know that she said it quite like that, but that was the general idea. And I think it's unfortunate. I've heard that there are some people down there that are afraid to come to the Sunstone. Do these people realize that they live in the United States of America where people are free and they cannot be burned at the stake? Now, there are stakes that'll try to burn them, probably, but but they can't be burned at the stake. They've got to start acting like free people if they want to have genuine freedom.
Okay, well, Sterling,
I don't know what.
I think that's a.
That's
I love
a,
that.
That's
Thank
the best
you.
Advice that I could give is to take the freedom. If they throw you out, you get thrown out.
There are some of us, however, who aren't at BYU and perhaps aren't in situations where we could exercise that kind of courage or where we have that opportunity. But when we hear about things such as, you know, the Allreds we talked to in the hall today, where they're not permitted
yes.
to speak at their one son's coming home from a mission, the other son's leaving.
A disgraceful thing.
It really is. Now, this is very painful. How, in terms of handling it and kind of staying in the church, do
what
you have
do?
Any advice for emotionally?
Yes, I wouldn't send my son on a mission. That would be my advice. If they wouldn't let me speak at his farewell, I would tell him to stay home. I mean that very seriously. You know, I'm amazed. I don't know how many of you have seen excommunication papers. I have, because I have so many friends that have been excommunicated. They show me the stuff. I don't know what it is now, but each that I have seen, and I have copies of them, several, not a lot, but several, it says, among other things, you can't go to priesthood meeting, but we encourage you to come to your other meetings. Well, that's a fine thing, you know. You throw a man out and encourage him to come to the meetings. It's very strange. But the church will no longer accept your tithes and offerings. But then it says, the ones I have, and whether that was, I think it must have been standard at one time, I don't know whether it is now or not, then it says, but we urge you to deposit your money in an account so that if and when you come back into the church, we will accept the money. Well, that's something, isn't it? To throw people out of the church who are willing to pay money to the church to keep it going. It's almost beyond belief. Now, you're not going to believe this one, and I didn't believe it until the proof was forthcoming. A former dean at the BYU who did not request excommunication, and he was not at the BYU at the time, but he had been, a wonderful person, a leading educator, whom the stake decided to excommunicate. And his letter, and I have a copy of it, when he first told me this, I couldn't believe it. His letter says, we will no longer, or the church will not accept your tithes and offerings, but we urge you to pay that money through some relative who is in good standing. Now, I have a copy of that letter. Can you believe it? Did you throw people out and urge them to continue to pay their tithing? Not only their tithing, but their offerings. I mean, this thing, I don't know what's going on now, but it sure needed a little cleaning up, I'd say.
Okay. Sterling, if I could, might take a turn here briefly, let me just comment that these letters said that the men could not go to priesthood meeting anymore, right?
But they that's right.
Of course, that's the way women have had it all along, isn't it?
That's right.
Anyhow, let's
well,
turn
to... Well, you see, that is lowering men to the level of women. That's getting pretty rough.
That's true. Women are the lowest level participants in the organization. All right, turning to influences in your life, though, you and Natalie are just an amazing couple. I mean, everyone who knows you, I mean, they just never fight. They're so sweet together. They're just such a joy to be with. What is your... And I wish, you know, she would not be interviewed. I mean, it is so neat, her comments back and forth. It's really...
I hope she's here.
She is. What y'all have been married 56 years.
That's right.
In June. What's the secret of a long and happy marriage?
Well, it's just living the way the church tells you to live. Now, I being the dominant male, hold the priesthood. And we have that understanding in accordance with the basic principles that she can make decisions in all the little things, I'll make the decisions in the big things. You know, little things like, shall we buy a new car? That's her decision. Shall we go on a vacation? And where shall we go? That's her decision. Shall we paint the house? Or plan to sell it? That's her decision. Now, of course, the big decisions are mine. Now, this is the secret of getting along well for 56 years. The big decisions are mine. I made the decision as to whether we should admit China to the United Nations. Well, that's the way it's set up, you know. That's the whole idea, I think, of the priesthood. And
would you mind sharing with us about when you and Natalie first met, or when you first saw her?
Oh, when I first saw her, I almost swooned. I was on a stairway at the university in what was called the L building. It's now the mathematics building, I guess. I was going down the stairway. It's when I was a student. And she was coming up. She swears she didn't see me, but I saw her, and I knew I had known her in the pre-existence. I knew she was meant for me. And we had our first date on June 8th, 1935. We had a whirlwind courtship. 3 years later to the day, I married her.
And she converted to the church, right?
Oh, well, of course. Heavens, you wouldn't expect me to marry a non-Mormon, would you? Well, Natalie came from a half-Mormon family. Her father was a Jack Mormon, and her mother was a Campbellite. But her mother joined the church. Not as a result of us, but as a result of one of Natalie's brothers and his wife. They converted her in her later years. She was very happy in the church. Church can bring a great deal of happiness to people. And that's the best thing about the church. That's the only point in having a church, as a matter of fact, is to bring some kind of happiness to people.
Sterling, you've had some wonderful friends in the church throughout all these years, one of the oldest of which is Lowell Binion. Would you like to share about your relationship with Lowell? And didn't you buy his car one time?
I sure did. $40. It's a 26 Oldsmobile. And it shimmied, and he warned me, don't go over 34 miles an hour or the thing will shake to pieces. And I went over 34 miles an hour, and it did shake to pieces. Had to take it to a garage, needed a universal joint. Cost me $5. Lowell had never had it fixed. Well, I have quite a few friends now, I think, but I haven't had very many friends. And the oldest friend, in terms of the time span, is a friend of mine from childhood who lives in Provo. Some of you may know him. Charles Peterson, Chuck Peterson, they call him. But Lowell Durham, not Lowell Durham, Lowell Binion. Lowell Binion is the oldest friend that I have of a continuous friendship except for Peterson from my childhood. I met Lowell Binion when he started to do the institute work at the University of Utah, and he had classes at the University Ward. I didn't take any of his classes. I'm sorry I didn't. I didn't take his classes, but I met him, and we became very good friends. Now, that would have been, I think, in 1936. And later, the same year, the next year, I gained two other friends. His brother Lynn Binion, and Obert Tanner. Now, they are the three oldest friends that I have. That is, not in terms of age, but in terms of the time that we have had a lasting friendship. Of course, Obert died just a year ago. But Lowell is a wonderful person, all three of them, marvelous human beings. Lowell is a wonderful person. It should have been an apostle. I mean, I've never been consulted about who should be appointed as apostle. I wish they would consult me sometime. I would have had Lowell as an apostle, and I would have had Marion D. Hanks as an apostle. I told Duff Hanks that about a year or two ago. Well, he says that makes two votes for us. But I would say we have a couple of new apostles now, and I think they're an excellent choice, both of them, Jeff Holland and Brother Hales. I think they're... you're talking about who should be appointed an apostle. You have to think in terms of the reservoir of people who are potential apostles, you know. I mean, you can't go out and just get anybody. There's a limited group that you might think might conceivably be in the picture. And as I say, though I wasn't consulted on it, I certainly would vote for both of these new apostles and the new president of the church, Brother Hunter. It's too bad he didn't become president some years ago. But I think he's a wonderful person, a very, very decent, genteel human being.
Do you want to share with us about when you and Natalie first met with Brother and Sister Hunter?
Oh, yes. Well, Natalie wasn't there. I was a house guest of Brother Hunter's some years ago. Brother and Sister Hunter, his wife died. I think he remarried President Hunter. They were building a home up not far from us, and we used to go through all these houses just before they were finished and take a look at them. And Natalie said, if you want to see that home of Apostle Hunter's, you better get over there and go through it. So I stopped on a Saturday morning and went around and went in the lower floor. It was on a hill. The door was unlocked, and I went in and looked around. It was a very nice place, beautiful place, recreation room and a stairway. I went up the stairway and walked in on them having breakfast in their nightgowns. Anyway, I got acquainted with them. They're lovely. They invited me to breakfast and showed me through the house. And he was in his pajamas. She had a bathrobe or something on, or whatever women call those things. They're wonderful people, I thought.
Okay, Sterling, taking another turn here.
He hasn't invited me back, incidentally.
Taking another turn here. You were appointed to the Kennedy administration as Commissioner of Education. You're not a political person. How did that appointment come about?
Well, I've often wondered. Actually, I got a call a couple of nights before President Kennedy was inaugurated from Al Urich. He was vice president of the Ford Foundation. And he told me that President Kennedy had asked him, and I think some others, if they would propose somebody to be Commissioner of Education. And they had a meeting. I don't know who all was there. John Gardner, president of the Carnegie Corporation, was one, and Urich, vice president of the Ford Foundation. Anyway, they wanted to propose me, and he wanted to know if I'd take the job. You know, I didn't know there was such a thing as a commissioner of education. I should have known that, but I really didn't. But I thought, well, it's a proper thing to do if the president wants me, and so they appointed me. They didn't. Beyond that, I was never asked if I'd take the job. I went to Washington, and they just said the president will make the announcement this afternoon. And that was that. I found that I had one very important qualification. I didn't know it at the time, but I heard a telephone conversation with the president where they said he doesn't belong to the NEA. That's the National Education Association. And I later was told that President Kennedy, and I think that's why they appointed me. They were looking for somebody who didn't belong to the NEA. I was later told that President Kennedy was determined to not appoint anyone who belonged to the NEA, which was then a very conservative operation.
Sterling, what did President Kennedy think of Utah? What did he think of Mormons?
Well, he didn't ever tell me what he thought of Mormons. But he did say, you know, I was with him in the Oval Office one day when he said, you know, the people of Utah didn't vote for me. And he brought it up, I didn't. Well, I said, I know they didn't, but I said, you know, you're really very popular out there. They like you anyway. I don't know whether that was true or not. But it was certainly the proper thing to say. On occasion, there were occasions he asked me, for instance, once to extend his regards to President McKay and also to one or two other leading figures in the church among the apostles. The other two, I know, were both Democrats. But I didn't ever discuss Mormonism with him, though he knew I was a Mormon. No question about that. He knew that.
Did the church come up in your Senate confirmation?
The church?
Or your being a Mormon? Was that raised in, when you were confirmed by the
Senate?
Well,
as a matter of fact, just one thing. In the hearing before the Senate committee, Senator Clark, I think it was, of Pennsylvania, a person of real stature, said that, I understand that you are a Mormon, and I said yes, and he said, now, you understand this was way back in 1961, early in 1961. He said, in view of the fact that you're a Mormon, what would be your stand on such things as the integration of the schools, because that was becoming a major issue then. And I simply said to him, this is all published, the Congress published these things, and the statement's all published. I said, I simply don't agree with the Mormon Church on its policy with respect to the Negroes. We call them Negroes in those days, you know. With respect to the Negroes, and I said, I've made this very clear to the leading officials of the Mormon Church, and they know that I disagree with them. And I can fully support and will work for the integration of the school. That was the end of that. There was no other reference to my being a Mormon in the confirmation. I used to get introduced a good deal as a Mormon. I remember Abraham Ribicoff introducing me once to a large group of university presidents, and he said one thing that I'm pleased with is that he's not from the East, he's not from Harvard, and he's a Mormon. That was a little embarrassing to me. And the president of Harvard was there, but we got along fine. They were getting so many people from Harvard in the Kennedy administration, and he made that comment, you know.
Sterling, while you were in Washington, you were, of course, took many educational initiatives on a number of things. What is the most lasting thing you did while serving in that capacity?
Well, from the standpoint of legislation, we made some breakthroughs and laid the foundation for breakthroughs in the federal government furnishing funds to various areas of education. Now, from the standpoint of legislation. That was the important thing. But even more important in some ways, I think I managed to make it clear that the United States Office of Education, now the Department of Education, was not a function of the NEA. And in all, it's not unfair to say that to a considerable extent it had been, that the NEA was pretty well controlling what went on there. That, I think, is a major development. And the other thing that I would be willing to mention is that I made it clear that I felt that my function was to be a critic of the schools and the people at the and the educational organizations, not for higher education. I had no problem with them, but for lower education, they felt that my only function was to try to get federal money for them. That was the function. And it's almost unbelievable, some of the things that actually occurred. It would take too long to tell you as to how they assumed that the Commissioner of Education, or now the Secretary of Education, should just keep his damn mouth shut about what goes on in the schools unless he could praise them. That was the attitude of many of the leaders. Not all of them, you understand. There's one from Utah who was highly placed in the NEA, who was a man of real stature. But I'm referring to Alan West, whom some of you would know. He didn't fit that pattern at all. The idea that anyone should be critical of the public schools or even the private schools of America was anathema to them. It was hard for me to believe. And they were very much opposed to me. They were opposed to me because I believed in merit pay for teachers, because I believed that teachers should be thoroughly educated in the subject which they taught, and so on. I mean, I think they got $10 or something from every member, and by gosh, $10 from the worst teacher in the country was just as good at $10 as from the best teacher. Anyway, I shouldn't dwell on that. You understand, I got along with them fine. They didn't like me, and I didn't like some of them. But we were gentlemen about it, you know, most of the time.
Sterling, while you were in that capacity and sense, I mean, but you made a lot of speeches. I remember as your student that I always took notes, and you never read from notes. That you come into class and lecture for several hours without referring to a note. But you were in Washington D.C. and you were making speeches all over. And isn't there an interesting story about the White House in clearing your speeches and stuff? Could you share that?
Yeah. Well, this note business has got me into trouble more than once. I don't use notes because I don't have any. I mean, you got to have notes if you're going to use notes. I don't have any notes. A student at the University of Utah came to me one day in about the second week of the class. He was an advanced student in the law school. And he said, "Do you want my criticism of you now or at the end of the course?" And I said, "Well, we just as well have it now." "Well," he said, "you're not prepared." I said, "Now what's your evidence that I'm not prepared?" And he said, "You don't have any notes." That took care of that. He didn't show up again. After he gave me that broadside, he quit the class. When I started teaching at the University of Southern California in the School of Philosophy, when I was put on the faculty, I was immediately put on a course that had three of my former teachers on it. And it was one of these big affairs, you know, like we used to have after the war, several hundred students that come to lectures and then go to discussion sections and so on. And the requirement was that we take turns giving the lectures, and that each person, faculty person, attend the other person's lectures. That was a part of the requirement. And it was a nice arrangement. Well, I went, and here were these teachers of mine, you know. There was a pulpit thing like this, and they had their notes and so on, and I thought, my hell, what am I going to do? When it comes my turn, I don't have any notes. And this concerned me a great deal. It really did. And I finally hit upon a wonderful solution. I just got a manila folder with a lot of blank yellow pages, and I would turn them from time to time and look down, and they didn't know the difference. So I got by with it. Well, this thing that Laurie mentions, it was not long after I became Commissioner of Education. I was going up to Harvard to deliver a lecture, and formal lectures, I preferred to write them, you know. They brought me a man who was to be my speechwriter. He had been my predecessor's speechwriter. Well, I said, I'm going to write my own speeches. They couldn't believe that. But I said, you have to find something else. He was a nice person. You have to find something else for him to do. I'm not going to have him writing speeches for me. And I never did have anybody do that. Well, I did let him write. I was supposed to write some kind of a chapter on federal aid to education for a Boy Scout manual or something. And I let him write that. And then went over just one thing, and that was the end of it. But I was just ready to leave, had the manuscript, had written this paper to deliver at Harvard, and I received word that the White House had ruled that everyone who was in a position of policy making in the administration would have to have their addresses cleared through the White House. And my gosh, you know, that was a shock to me. I couldn't believe it. But I was new in politics. Well, I wasn't politically involved at all, for that matter. And anyway, I had to phone back several times to see if the White House had cleared my paper to read at Harvard. The last minute, it was cleared. And so I decided then I would write no more speeches. I'd just speak extemporaneously, which was the easiest thing to do. And then the general counsel of the office came to me, and he says, we've worked something out with the White House. He said, if you just have notes, they don't have to be cleared. So after that, when I wanted to write an address for a formal, I would just entitle it Notes for an Address. And I didn't have to send it over to the White House. It was a very, very good arrangement.
I should say that while at the U, I was simply amazed sitting there day after day. Really, he's sitting like he is now, giving a lecture without any notes and recognizing that this is publishable material. I mean, someone could have a tape recorder and just transcribe it and publish it. It was wonderful. Sterling, you have so much experience in higher education, long years of distinguished service to the University of Utah. You have been trustees on the board of trustees of many universities, some in Europe. You have been asked to be president of more colleges and universities. I mean, I just hope I have job interviews at that many colleges. And anyway, what I'm wondering is, how would you describe your relationship with Brigham Young University?
Oh, it's been a very pleasant relationship, as I've already told you. I think a lot of their faculty ought to walk out. But I taught there in the summer. I think I mentioned this last year in the interview with Jack. I taught there in the summer of 47, and it was really a delightful experience. Sidney Sperry had spies in my classes, but that's all right. I knew who they were. And if you know there are spies there, you can enjoy it. You know, I had more spies at the BYU when I was at the University of Utah in the 50s especially. I had more spies at the BYU than Wilkinson had. They didn't know what they're members of the faculty. They would come running up to Salt Lake and bring me everything they were not supposed to show and tell me what's going on when they things that they weren't supposed to tell about. And so I kept up on the BYU, had a very pleasant relationship with him. Dick Paul, a wonderful person who passed away recently, as you know, came to see me one day. This is back in the 50s. He had just come up from a session with Joseph Fielding Smith. He said Joseph Fielding Smith had sent for him, wanted to talk to him. So he went to Salt Lake and had a session with Joseph Fielding Smith. And he said the main thing he told me was that I should stay away from you. So he came right up and told me that. Well, you need to have loyal friends planted in all of these places. And I had them down at the BYU. But after I taught there through the summer session, a year later, I came to the University of Utah, and there was a ban on me that I wasn't to be permitted to give a lecture at the BYU. And that was very true. The dean of the College of Science had a faculty group, wanted me to review the book on the Old Testament. Is our time up? By Heber C. Snell, a fine book, and they wanted me to give a review of it. These were all faculty people and their wives, and they wouldn't permit the thing to be held on the BYU campus. If you can believe that, they had to hold it in his home. That was Thomas Martin, the dean of College of Applied Science. And a few years ago, this would have been in the 70s, the AAUP chapter at the BYU, American Association of University Professors, I didn't know they had a chapter of that, but they did. And the president of it invited me to come down and give a talk at one of their meetings on academic freedom and tenure. And I said to him, you know, this won't go at the BYU. I said, yeah, fine. He said, we have sent out very, very careful notices to people whom we've carefully selected, and we didn't mention your name in the notice. Well, anyway, just for the hell of it, I went down, and my wife Natalie went with me, and also Rich Kendall, who was my associate and as dean of the graduate school. He's now superintendent of schools of Davis County. He's absolutely first rate. We went down, took our wives to dinner, and then we went to the place. They had to hold it off the campus, and they held it down in that. It was then it's what is now the Utah Valley College, but the old campus. And that's where the meeting was scheduled to be held. And only one man came. There were three officers of the AAUP, and the four of us, and then one man came and sat in the a little ways away. They told me he was the official spy. That's what they told me. They didn't tell me that until afterwards, that he was the spy. Didn't make any difference. I wasn't going to hurt the place, you know. I told them they shouldn't expect to have academic freedom in matters pertaining to religion and morals, and that they shouldn't expect to have tenure. I wasn't down there to create problems. I said, if you guys think that you're going to have real academic freedom, you're barking up the wrong tree. You shouldn't have come here in the first place. J. Reuben Clark gave a speech in 1938 that I was present. I was a seminary teacher, and he gave it at Aspen. It was published in the Improvement Era at Aspen. Is that what's called Aspen Grove up the BYU summer campus up there behind Timpanogos? And President Clark made the official statement that teachers of the church should not expect to have what is called intellectual freedom in matters pertaining to religion and morals. Well, anybody who goes to and that has been reiterated more than once. I remember it being quoted at the inauguration of Dallin Oaks as president of the university. Anybody that goes to teach at the BYU should face that fact. They should face it and not go there. Now, I think the unfortunate thing about this whole affair, the BYU and the excommunication did Apostle Packer call them intellectuals or something? Intellectuals, so-called excommunication. If it gets out of hand, and it could, if it doesn't slow down, it create a real brain drain for the church. It's a bad thing for the people who suffer under it. Some people suffer and some people don't, but it's a bad thing for the church. The church can't afford to discipline people like Clark Knowlton. That's his name, isn't it? David Knowlton. His father's Clark. I know his father. And Levina Anderson. What is the crime that Levina Anderson has committed? What crime that she should be thrown out of the church? I mean, it's almost beyond belief. It's just almost beyond belief that a church should excommunicate a woman like that who has served the church all her years and who has done nothing to hurt the church simply because she wrote some stuff listing some of the unfortunate things that have happened in the church. Well, my Lord, if the church is going to throw people like that out, they ought to throw most of us out. There's no point in not doing it. And you might raise the question, well, why don't we quit? That's a serious question as to why you should tolerate a membership in a church that will do this sort of thing. Well, I suppose one reason is that we know the church does an enormous amount of good. It's a good thing. We're part of the culture, part of the tradition and all that. And we can always hope that things are going to change. And maybe they will. I personally think that if President Hunter had become president, say, 20 years ago, knowing what I do or what I believe to be the nature of his personality and his attitudes, that a lot of this would change. Now, he's in advanced years and in bad health, and what will happen remains to be seen. But it's a real question. You take this young Benson fellow, President Benson's grandson, and his wife who quit the church. I'm sorry they quit the church, but I admire their courage for their willingness to do it. When he felt that the church is lying, as it obviously was, about the condition of his grandfather, And he just couldn't take it any longer. I admire him for his courage, though I'm very sorry to see a person like that voluntarily pull out of the church. The church is a great institution, a great deal of value in it. I don't know where you would turn to a better church. Most of these churches, you know, after all, those of us who are a little bit on the questionable side, like me and some of you, I know, have more fun being in the church than we would have if we were in the Methodist church or the Episcopal church. My Lord, you just go to sleep. I mean, it's an interesting thing to be a part of Mormondom, in spite of the fact that things go on that you don't like. That there must needs be opposition in all things.
That's right. Well, Sterling, you have defended the church and defended Mormons in a lot of settings, and in, I think, some critical settings, you've defended BYU.
Well, that's quite true. It'd take too long for me to comment on that, though. BYU's accreditation you're referring to?
Right, right.
Yeah, well, that's a number of years ago. I had to go to bat for the BYU. I just took the... Well, I think I'll tell you what I told... I was a member of the Accrediting Association, the Accrediting Commission that accredits the universities in Utah and the Northwest. I think I'll just tell you what I said to the commission after they had gone through this thing over and over and over again. Their opposition to full accreditation was actually against Wilkinson. And I finally said in quite a, I think, quite a fiery speech to my colleagues on the commission, there is a university with several thousand first-rate students and a good faculty, and some of them excellent faculty, and you cannot discipline this university just because it has a son of a bitch for president. And I won.
You didn't. It wasn't only you that won.
No, I like Wilkinson, you know, but that kind of language won the day. What do you say?
I think it is very significant that with the tensions and the way that BYU had been treating you, you went to bat for them and saved the day, and I think that's wonderful.
Well, the BYU treats me fine. They just don't want me down there making speeches.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, aside from that.
I don't object. As a matter of fact, I then learned that I would be allowed to come and make one speech, but not a series. Oh, I've made lots of speeches down at the BYU since then.
Okay.
I don't think they'd want me down there. Now. Well, I've known all of the presidents. I've liked them. Wilkinson did some very good things for the BYU. He wrecked it from an intellectual standpoint in one way, but he nevertheless wanted first-class people on the faculty. He wanted first-rate scientists and first-rate engineers. He didn't want first-rate religionists and first-rate sociologists and political scientists and people in philosophy, but he sold the church on the BYU, like his predecessor, Harris, had, I think, failed to do, though Harris was a great president, and he's the one who developed it as a university. But Wilkinson sold the church authorities on the BYU so that they would not only keep it, and there was some question as to whether they would keep it, they would not only keep it, they would pour money into it. And, of course, they built a great campus with marvelous buildings and everything else. So Wilkinson is it's a two-sided story when you talk about Wilkinson. He had his strengths and obvious weaknesses.
Okay. Sterling... there are other Mormons outside of the church in Salt Lake, like the ones that practice plural marriage. And I think you are familiar with some of these polygamous groups.
Oh, yes.
Would you care to comment on some of these groups?
I have some association with the friends of mine. Some of the friends are here with Colorado City. I'll have to tell you, we went down there not long ago, and there are four of us, and we had made arrangements in advance that we were coming, and they treated us like royalty. The people were delightful, and in the evening, they had a regular banquet. Now, a few years ago, I've had connections at Colorado City for some time. That is, I would go there. 20 years ago, the place was kind of closed. They were suspicious of you if you came around. That's not the case. They were open and friendly and in every way. And the mayor, Dan Barlow, I just want to tell you one story. At this banquet which they held for us, we raised a number of questions with them, and Dan Barlow fielded a lot of these questions. Wouldn't you say, Ernie? He was the center of it. Ernest Polson was one of us. One of the things we talked about, of course, was their being incarcerated in Arizona when the governor of Arizona came up with the militia. And they met them out in the road singing hymns. It was a big fiasco, you know, the way the governor behaved. And Dan Barlow told us about what they had to go through to get out of jail, the men. He said one of the things we had to do was sign a document saying that we would never again practice polygamy. Now, he says, that was easy enough for us to do because we didn't need any practice. I tell you, he was great. See him on television once in a while when you see these polygamy films. Most of these polygamy groups are very peaceful, pleasant people. After all, they're only trying to do what Joseph Smith said you should do and that Brigham Young said you should do. It's the rest of us that have departed from the true faith. I say the rest of us, those of us here who are monogamists. That may not include everybody here. Now you do get these lunatic fringe groups that shoot one another and so on. That's terrible, but that Colorado City group is of course not like that. Mormonism has its more than its share of serious lunatic fringers, and it deserves them in a way. Well, what I mean, it lays a basis for them. This idea that everybody can have revelations. If there was ever a piece of nonsense perpetrated on the human race, it is that we can all have revelations. Well, Lord, you get everybody having revelations and then have a history of polygamy. What do you expect? People are going to have revelations. It's just a piece of, in my opinion, it's just a piece of sheer nonsense. That's the church just opening itself up to anarchy. And I don't know why it continually does it. I mean, if you're going to believe in revelation, you had better tie it down to a comparative few who are going to have the revelation, or at least define what a revelation is, so that a person knows when he had a revelation or when he just got indigestion. Well, that's a point, you know, that Brigham Young made. And this guy came and asked him to interpret his dream. He said, "Tell me what kind of pie you ate before you went to bed." It's just a matter of basic common sense, and it produces anarchy. And I don't see why the church, which is so opposed to individuals going in their own direction still perpetrates the idea of everyone being able to have revelation. That no Mormon writer, in my opinion, that I've ever read, I haven't read all of them, I guess, but I don't know of a single Mormon writer that ever contributed a paragraph to the real meaning of revelation as to what is a revelation and how you would identify it and so on. You get a lot of nonsense about shaking hands with spirits or something. If you can't feel their hands, they're bad spirits. If you can feel their hands, they're good spirits. All that kind of nonsense. The church is filled with good stuff, and it's filled with nonsense. And one of the jobs that we have, really, is to clean out a lot of the nonsense and learn to identify and celebrate the real intellectual and moral and spiritual strengths of the church, because they're present, but they're commonly overlooked. They're just commonly overlooked.
Well, Sterling, while we're on this, would you elaborate the intellectual and spiritual moral strengths of the church? What do you regard as a major strength?
Well, of course, let me tell you a couple of stories that indicate to me what Mormonism is about. Just a couple of stories that I think are worth communicating to you. Darrell Chase, who later was president of the university in Logan, was earlier director of the Institute of Religion at the University of Arizona. And he told me this story soon after it happened. The campus pastors, of which he was one of the heads for the campus of the University of Arizona, the various religions, you see, and the student organizations, were going to have a meeting to deal with the problem of what should be done about housing for the migrant workers in Arizona. Now, this is way back in the 30s, late 30s. The migrant workers in Arizona were just living in shacks made of cardboard, many of them. I saw them. It was a terrible condition. Now this student organization was going to have a meeting to discuss what should be done. And they were arranging for the program, and they asked Darrell Chase, how many Mormon students will be there? Oh, he said, none of them. And they said, no, you mean tell me none of your students will come out? Aren't they interested in the migrant workers? Well, he says, I'll tell you, they're not going to come out and talk about it. But if you should decide to build some houses for these migrant workers, they'll all be there. They'll be there with their saws and hammers. Now, that's one side of Mormonism, you see, that is a source of great strength. That is the capacity to do things. It's a marvelous thing. What the church does, there's no need of my commenting on it, because it's perfectly obvious to all of us. Now, the other story I want to mention is an occasion when my wife and I, we have a cabin up on Kolob Mountain in southern Utah, and we were driving up the mountain, and we came upon an encampment of Boy Scouts. They were hiking up the mountain. They were in their Boy Scout uniforms, and as we drove along, there must have been 50 or 60 of them. One little kid who was a Mexican couldn't have been more, I don't know how old you had to be a Boy Scout. He couldn't have been over 12, 13 years old. He walked out to the road and held up his hand and stopped us. And he looked in the car, looked around at both of us, and he said, "Are you folks members of the church?" And Natalie said, "Oh, yes, we're members of the church." She said, "Are you homesick?" "Oh," he was homesick. "Where are you from?" "He's from Sacramento." And it's kind of kind of silly, but this this event with this little kid had quite an impact on me. Anyway, Natalie said, he was from Sacramento. She said, "Oh, you don't have to." He said, when she said, "Yes, we're members of the church," he said, "Oh, good, good." Well, she said, "Now you don't have to worry, because all of the people that you see up here are members of the church." He said, "Oh, good." And he turned around and went back. Now, to me, this really indicates something that is very, very real and very central and very precious about Mormonism. You see, it's this sense of belonging to something. To be a member of the church is like being a member of the family. And it's more than a religion in the ordinary sense. It's more than the acceptance of religious dogma and religious ritual. It's more than simply being a cultural Mormon. Now, I'm a cultural Mormon. I don't believe much of the teaching of the church on matters of doctrine, but I certainly am as much affected by the existence of the church as anybody that's in it. It's a very strange thing that some people suppose that if you don't believe everything, that in some way or another you don't have an appreciation for the church or the religion. Now, that's just a lot of nonsense. It's just a lot of sheer nonsense. The strength of Mormonism lies in the fact that it can be a haven for people, as it was for this this little Mexican kid. It didn't matter who we were. If we were members of the church, then he felt good. Well, I went for the State Department some years ago and was for about a half a year in Iran. And there were a few Americans there. And, you know, I was a little shocked when I, the first day I was there, somebody approached me and called me by name, and I thought, "My Lord, I'm caught clear over here. It's like you can't escape the home teachers, you know." I hadn't been there very long before I looked forward to Sundays, when that little handful of people from Utah, some Mormons and some not Mormons, got together. And we had, I used to say, we had the best adult Aaronic priesthood between Iraq and Lebanon. Well, there's something, now maybe not all people who are in the church are affected that way. I'm just being very frank in saying that that's the way it affects me. And yet, you know, if they were to throw me out, which they, for all I know, they may have thrown me out since between last night and now. I just haven't received the mail yet. But if they were to throw me out, I wouldn't object to it. Now, this may seem very strange to some of you. I wouldn't object. I can see no good reason why they shouldn't. I mean, with their way of looking at things, with their way of looking at things, they ought to throw a lot of us out. I just think their way of looking at things is not the very best way.
Sterling, we saw the movie Legacy this week down at the Joseph Smith Memorial Building.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Would you like to comment on that? I think we're hitting it something very important here. What is, in terms of what the essence of religion is in people's lives?
That movie is very impressive. I hadn't seen it. I saw it yesterday, or day before yesterday. It's well produced. I think the church done a great thing in the with that Hotel Utah building. I was one of those who certainly thought it was terrible to get rid of the hotel. It was one of the great hotels of the world, actually, in my opinion. But it was losing money for the church. There's no question about that, and it looked bad for them to get rid of it. Well, now, actually, except for the fact that you can't go there and find a room to sleep in, except for that, it's a finer place than it was before. If you haven't gone through the building, you should. There are more public rooms. They're more beautiful. The whole thing is magnificent. They've done a marvelous job with it. That movie is an impressive production that pretty well describes the moving power of Mormonism in its early period. I don't know what more to say about it, but it's if you haven't done it, you should go see it. Those of us who live here are not supposed to go to it yet because there's so many visitors. But Laurie DePadova was a visitor, and she got some tickets and invited us to go with her.
Okay. Sterling, one question I can't resist asking you. Many women in the church today have found comfort in the idea that we have a mother in heaven, and consider that a strength of Mormon theology. There are women in other religions that would just long for that kind of doctrine. Could you share with us what you think of that and why that notion is so opposed by the leadership today?
Well, we know why it's opposed by the leadership. As my mother-in-law once said, she was not a member of the church then, and we took her to a conference, and we sat up in the balcony in the back in the tabernacle, and everyone you could see downstairs was a man. I think they reserved the lower section for bishops and so on, and they're all men. I'll never forget her saying, well, kind of under her breath, well, it always was a man's church. Well, that's what it is. The men run it, they shove the women around, there's no question about that. You know, this marvelous president of the Relief Society a few years ago, Bell Spafford, she told Natalie and me on one occasion of some of the things that had been done to take away from the Relief Society their prerogatives. It was outrageous, absolutely outrageous. No question about it. I had an experience. I think I'll tell you this. It'll tell you, do we have any time left?
Yes, we do.
I think I'll tell you this. Numerous writers get in touch with me who want to write stuff about Mormonism. It was truer a few years ago than it is now. And a man called me from Florida, wanted to talk to me and see if he could make an appointment to meet with me because he was doing some writing on women. He wanted to write a piece on Mormon women. And he obviously was a person of some quality. I could tell from talking with him, and I said I'd be happy to meet with him. So I asked him if he would like me to make some appointments with Mormon women for him to meet. That pleased him, so I did make some appointments. I made an appointment with Emma Lou Thane, for instance, whom many of you know, and two or three other Mormon women whom I thought would be worth his meeting. And, of course, I made an appointment with the president of the Relief Society. I think her name was Barbara Smith. Would that be right? And he was such a decent human being, I wanted to be helpful to him. So In each case, I picked him up at the Hotel Utah, drove him to the home of the person, and introduced him, and then left. I didn't go in, of course. I left. And then after his time with this person, he would get a cab to go back to the hotel. Well, in the case of the Relief Society president, I told him that her office was right near the hotel. I'd meet him and just walk over with him, which I did in the morning. And as we got to the Relief Society building, there was a very nice woman who said to me, Sister Smith is expecting you, took us to an elevator, and we went up. Now, all I would have done is at the door introduced him to Sister Smith and would have left. As we got off the elevator, here was an apostle to meet us. And he took him, and they went in to Sister Smith's office and closed the door. Now, what that means, I'm not sure, but I think it meant that she could not have an interview with some writer without the priesthood present. I could hardly believe that. It happened to be that this apostle was a friend of mine. I couldn't believe it. They knew we were coming up that elevator, and he was standing there as the elevator door opened and took him over. I got back on the elevator and got the hell out of there. Anyway, I think it's most unfortunate. Now, you didn't ask me about Relief Society presence. It was the Mother God. Now, you know, I don't know anything about God or Mrs. God, either one. I'll have to tell you a little story. Obert Tanner and I used to have an office together at the university. Soon after I joined the University of Utah faculty, and he said, I have a class in the philosophy of religion, and I take them down to the cathedral and down to the synagogue and Protestant churches and so on. And then I invite a Mormon in to talk to them about Mormonism. He says, who do you think I ought to get this quarter? Well, I said, get Lowell Bunyan. He says, I don't want Lowell Bunyan. I want the real raw stuff. He said, I don't want Lowell. He and Lowell were very good friends. He says, I want Mormonism in the raw. And he decided to get Milton R. Hunter, whom some of you may have known. And they got Mormonism in the raw, all right. I sat in the back of the class with a former teacher at the BYU. He said, let's go in and hear Milt Hunter. And we sat in the back of the room. And Milt Hunter, who then was one of the seven presidents of 70, First Council of 70, he did a good job of laying out Mormonism. And a nice young woman, one of the students up front, put up her hand when they came to questions and said, now, Dr. Hunter, it's my understanding that you Mormons believe that there's not only a Father God, but also a Mother God. You know, that used to be common teaching in the church. I don't know whether it is now or not. We sing, Oh My Father, and it ends with Common Sense Tells Me I Have a Mother There, and so on. He said, could that be true? And Milt said, oh yes, God's got a wife. Well, she said, if that is true, what would be wrong with praying to your mother in heaven? He said, oh no, a woman's place is in the home. Well, I think that's the answer to this question. You don't want the Mother God officiating in anything. Her place is in the home.
Sterling, you mentioned at the beginning of this interview that you have had hassles with the church for 50 years.
56 years.
Oh, 56 years. Excuse me, 56 years. And it seems to me from listening to you and reading your writings, not only in religion but in philosophy and other areas, that one of your core values is the sanctity of the individual.
Oh, yes.
That
yes.
Everyone is, and actually, you know, that's a core value of the gospel of Jesus Christ, that everyone is ultimately precious and of ultimate worth. Would you say that you got that from your Mormon background?
Well, as much as anything, I must say that I think most of my basic attitudes I got from the Mormon background. I was reared in a Mormon family. They were not fanatics, but churchgoers, and came up through the church like anybody else. I got an early start, however, on my downfall. I got started early on that. I think it was when I was in the fourth or fifth grade. I used to sing a song in Sunday school. I don't know whether they sing it now or not. How great the wisdom and the love. And it went like this: how great the wisdom and the love that filled the courts on high and sent the Savior from above to suffer, bleed, and die. And you know, as a kid, I thought that's a fine case of wisdom and love. Send the Savior to suffer, bleed, and die. Well, as I say, that was the beginning of my decline.
Well, this value...
Yeah, I declined for a long, long time.
This value of the individual, it seems to me that is the root of some of your impatience with institutions and the church, when it doesn't seem to value the individual.
Yes. Of course, the church is ready to say, of course we value the individual. It's the individual that is basically precious. But as you know, because you're in the field of corporate behavior, pretty hard for an institution to live up to its own ideals. I mean, that's not... I have a good deal of sympathy for the general authorities, and I have high admiration for most of them, not all of them, but most of them. They're people of high integrity, people of ability, and they're devoted to the church. But the problems that they face are sometimes immense in this sort of thing. Now, for instance, if some yokel who's a bishop and a state president excommunicates somebody, you're supposed to have an appeal to a higher authority. What do? Here's a bishop and a state president who are wearing their lives out, working for the church, raising money and tithing to send to Salt Lake. I lived in Arizona, and I tell you, the bishops there didn't like to send the money to Salt Lake. They used to seriously complain about that. But what are the general authorities going to do? These hard-working subordinates of theirs who work for nothing and work their lives out. It's a pretty hard thing to say, now look, we're just going to reverse everything that you've done and so on. Now sometimes they ought to do it, and I guess sometimes they do it, but it's not an easy thing to do. You just have to face the fact that the church is a big...
The 1994 Salt Lake Sandstone Symposium presents session number 375, an interview, Confessions of a Pious Heretic, a conversation with Sterling M. McMurrin. Interviewer, Laurie DiPadova.
Live coverage of the Salt Lake Sandstone Symposium. We're about to bring the final broadcast in this year's edition of the Sandstone Symposium, one of the most popular sessions in the 1993 symposium of last year, was an interview with Sterling M. McMurrin, a well-known Mormon theologian and authors of books such as The Philosophical Foundations of Mormon Theology and Religion, Reason, and Truth, Historical Essays in the Philosophy of Religion. He will be interviewed this year by Larry DePadova, who is a PhD candidate in organizational behavior at Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy, State University of New York at Albany, and who is also presented papers here at this year's Sunstone Symposium, and also a personal friend of Sterling McMurrin's. And so she'll be able to probe and push Sterling McMurrin into saying things that he might not otherwise say. They will be just sitting down a minute and getting ready to start our interview. And we'll go now to Larry DePadova, who will introduce Sterling McMurrin.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Larry DePadova, and it is my pleasure indeed to welcome you to this session of Sunstone, which is an interview with Sterling McMurrin. As you know, last year Jack Newell interviewed him, and that was a wonderful interview. Now, if y'all weren't here or don't have the tape, I hope Elbert still has copies, because it is a fantastic interview. And in Jack's absence this year, I'm pleased to be able to talk with Sterling. Let me just say that Jack and Sterling are doing a book called Conversations with Sterling McMurrin, which is based on a series of interviews that Jack has done with Sterling, and is a wonderful book. I want to commend that. Now, as everyone always says to a group like this, Sterling McMurrin needs no introduction. I mean, Sterling, I mean, everyone knows about you being in John Kennedy's administration. They know about your church work and teaching in the church. They know
what church work was that?
Oh, come on. They know about your writings, your distinguished service to the University of Utah. Jack described you as a loving critic of the church, but I'd like to also say, from what I've observed, you are the most ardent defender of Mormonism I've ever seen, an ardent defender of the church and of Mormons. And I'd like to just surface something that y'all undoubtedly know, that Sterling McMurrin is a real treasure to the church and a real treasure to all of us. He and his family, his wife Natalie, they're warm and gracious and generous in every way. And Sterling as I met him when I was a new convert years ago, and just amazing people just embody the very best of Mormonism and the best of humanity indeed. So I was interested, Sterling, in your the title of the interview. You told Elbert that you wanted it titled Confessions of a Pious Heretic. Would you mind telling us what you mean by that, what you mean by being a heretic, and how that's different from being an apostate?
Don't you have a wonderful southern accent? It's great. I remember in a high priest class, I think I went about once every 6 months, and the secretary said to me, Brother McMurrin, I always mark you as absent for other church work. I asked him what church work he had in mind. Well, he wasn't sure, but surely I was out doing some church work. I was just home asleep. It's rather important, I think, to recognize, in response to Larry's question, that there's a basic difference between a heretic and an apostate. It's a little like the case, I think, of the woman who was upbraiding a panhandler who was somewhat inebriated, and she said she wasn't going to give money to an alcoholic. And he said, "Lady, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm just a plain old drunk." "Well," she said, "what's the difference between an alcoholic and a drunk?" We said, "Lady, there's a lot of difference. There's a lot of difference. Us drunks don't have to go to them damn meetings." Now, that's the case with us heretics. Us heretics don't have to go to them trials along with you apostates. At least we're not supposed to. I was talking with the President Brown some years ago when he was in the first presidency about a friend who was up for excommunication, and I said, "Now, President Brown, he's a heretic. He is not an apostate. He's a heretic. And we do not," I was lying here, of course, I said, "we do not excommunicate heretics. We excommunicate apostates, not heretics." He said, "I hope not, because I'm one." He was a great one, too.
Well, Sterling, what would you say a heretic is, then?
I mean, well, a heretic is a person who doesn't believe. He's a heretic at certain points, or at all points, for that matter. I'm quite a thoroughgoing heretic. I can name a lot of points at which I'm a disbeliever. An apostate is a person who turns against the church. Heretics don't necessarily turn against the church. Apostates turn against the church. Now, I'm a pious heretic, as you mentioned. You see, somewhere in the scripture, or Joseph Smith or somebody said, there must needs be opposition in all things. Well, there must needs be opposition among heretics. There are good heretics and bad heretics. There are good apostates and bad apostates. Now, I'm a good apostate. I'm a good as you were. I'm a good heretic. Good heretics aren't really mad at the church. They just don't like some of the things that it teaches and some of the things that go on. But they're not mad at the church. Now, bad heretics are mad at the church. And there are bad heretics. But that's all right. I have no objection to them. Now, there are good apostates and bad apostates. I could name some bad apostates, but I'll name some good apostates, the Tanners. That is Sandra and what's his name?
Gerald.
Sandra and Gerald Tanner are good apostates. They're against the church, but they're honest and decent. And not only that, they're very competent. But there are apostates that are dishonest and are not decent. Now, that's quite a different type.
Okay.
So I think when you talk about heretics and apostates, you have to distinguish between them and then recognize that there's no point in getting upset over the fact that some people are heretics, some people may be apostates. That's just the way the world is.
Well, now, Sterling, as you know, a number of intellectuals and people who think differently have been excommunicated in the past year. You have not been excommunicated.
And
yet you
know
describe yourself as a heretic, a thorough heretic. Why do you think you've never been excommunicated?
Well, I'm just not an intellectual. It's them damn intellectuals that get into trouble, you know. Most of them are historians. They have the crazy notion that they ought to tell the truth about church history. And that gets them into trouble. But when you say, lots of people say to me, why haven't you been excommunicated? Well, I just have to say it's a little like a social worker there was interviewing a prostitute in Reno. And she said to her, how come a fine, upstanding young woman like you from one of Boston's first families with plenty of money and a fine education at Vassar College, how come you would end up as a prostitute in Reno? And she said, well, I don't know, I'm just lucky, I guess. Well, that's the way with me, and just lucky, I guess. But you know, excommunication is partly a function of geography. It depends on where you live. Now, of course, some of them are engineered from 47 East South Temple, and it doesn't matter much where you live. But insofar as they're engineered by the local authorities, they're the ones that are supposed to do it. Why, it just depends on where you live. Now, I live in the only true ward in the church. It's a wonderful ward. The people are decent, and I go to church regularly, at least once a year, mainly to dinners, high priest dinners. They're wonderful. But it depends in part on the kind of people that you're thrown in with. Some of these people, unfortunately, are thrown in stakes where there are, wards and stakes that have younger people are the worst to be in. These younger people who are just home from missions and so on, they can be terribly bigoted. I mean this quite seriously. The wards that have older people in them, or where the older people are more dominant, or the stakes where older people are more dominant, I think are the ones where you'll find the most genuine liberality and decency in matters of this kind. Years ago, I was on the Stake High Council of Southern Arizona Stake, and the very first meeting that I went to of the High Council, one of the members of the council said, the stake president was a man connected with the University of Arizona and a person of some stature. And one of the people on the High Council said, now what are we going to do about, what's his name, I forget the name, about having that excommunication trial for him? And the stake president, whose name was Orlando Ballantyne, some of you may have known him, said, no, I don't want to hear any more about that. There's not going to be anyone excommunicated in this stake as long as I'm stake president. Well, you know, you'll find people like that. And then you'll find others who are just looking around to find somebody that they can put the bee on and get them excommunicated. And that's very unfortunate, because the question of justice in the church, you see, is very, very uneven. Very uneven. There's no reason in the world why some of these people, like this young man Wright at Brandeis, a Middle Eastern scholar who was recently excommunicated. I read his statement and the stake president's statement to him. No reason in the world why he should be excommunicated, and guys like me should not be. That doesn't make any sense at all. This man is much more of a believer, if one can take what he wrote, and I'm sure you can, is far more of a believer than I am. It doesn't make a bit of sense. It's not a bit of justice for him to be excommunicated. And for people like me, and a lot of people like you, are left in the church. It's wrong. It shouldn't be done that way. I mean, they ought to get all of us or none of us.
Well, now, Sterling, as you know, with geography and this question of justice and all, this is a very painful time.
Of course it is.
We've had A lot of our good friends excommunicated, people we look up to and respect and admire, excommunicated for reasons that seem very bogus, frankly. What advice do you have for us in handling these sorts of things?
Well, I don't know that you can do very much about it. Now, you know, I was invited. There have been a couple of petitions printed in the Tribune with many signatories. I was invited to sign each of those. I didn't sign them. For one thing, I didn't like the way they were written, but that's beside the point. I have plenty of sympathy and don't disapprove of other people signing them. But I've been in a kind of a hassle with the church for over 50 years, and I just prefer to go it alone. And I don't think a lot of these petitions and love marches and so on do a bit of good. The general authorities are not affected by that. They are affected by some things, but they're not affected, in my opinion, by these petitions. Now, I think, actually, if 50 first-rate people at the BYU would stand up the way they ought to and say, by damn, this sort of thing down here has got to stop, or we'll all walk out, that might do some good. You know, the University of Utah in 1915 had the biggest hassle in its history. It wasn't a very large institution in 1915, but about 17 people on the faculty did walk out, and it produced a reform in the University of Utah. And the net result was, though it took a little time, the net result was that the church took its hands off the University of Utah. Though it took a little time, but it was these people walking out in 1915 that made the difference. I'm frankly of the opinion that there would be far more freedom of thought and expression in the church if the people would simply take it. That there would be far more intellectual freedom at the BYU if the people down there, more of them, if more of them had the courage to be free. It takes a certain amount of courage to be free and stand up against the tide. And there aren't enough of them down there doing it. There are some. Martha Bradley, an example, she walked out, she said, to hell with it. Well, I don't know that she said it quite like that, but that was the general idea. And I think it's unfortunate. I've heard that there are some people down there that are afraid to come to the Sunstone. Do these people realize that they live in the United States of America where people are free and they cannot be burned at the stake? Now, there are stakes that will try to burn them, probably, but they, but they can't be burned at the stake. They've got to start acting like free people if they want to have genuine freedom.
Okay, well, Sterling,
I don't know what.
I think that's a.
That's
I love a, that.
That's
Thank
the best
you.
Advice that I could give is to take the freedom. If they throw you out, you get thrown out.
There are some of us, however, who aren't at BYU and perhaps aren't in situations where we could exercise that kind of courage or where we have that opportunity. But when we hear about things such as, you know, the Allreds we talked to in the hall today, where they're not permitted
yes.
to speak at their one son's coming home from a mission, the other son's leaving.
A disgraceful thing.
It really is. Now, this is very painful. How, in terms of handling it and kind of staying in the church, do
what
you have
do?
Any advice for emotionally?
Yes, I wouldn't send my son on a mission. That would be my advice. If they wouldn't let me speak at his farewell, I would tell him to stay home. I mean that very seriously. You know, I'm amazed. I don't know how many of you have seen excommunication papers. I have, because I have so many friends that have been excommunicated. They show me the stuff. I don't know what it is now, but each that I have seen, and I have copies of them, several, not a lot, but several, it says, among other things, you can't go to priesthood meeting, but we encourage you to come to your other meetings. Well, that's a fine thing, you know. You throw a man out and encourage him to come to the meetings. It's very strange. But the church will no longer accept your tithes and offerings. But then it says, the ones I have, and whether that was, I think it must have been standard at one time. I don't know whether it is now or not. Then it says, but we urge you to deposit your money in an account so that if and when you come back into the church, we will accept the money. Well, that's something, isn't it? To throw people out of the church who are willing to pay money to the church to keep it going. It's almost beyond belief. Now, you're not going to believe this one, and I didn't believe it until the proof was forthcoming. A former dean at the BYU who did not request excommunication, and he was not at the BYU at the time, but he had been, a wonderful person, a leading educator, whom the stake decided to excommunicate. And his letter, and I have a copy of it, when he first told me this, I couldn't believe it. His letter says, we will no longer, or the church will not accept your tithes and offerings, but we urge you to pay that money through some relative who is in good standing. Now, I have a copy of that letter. Can you believe it? Did you throw people out and urge them to continue to pay their tithing? Not only their tithing, but their offerings. I mean, this thing, I don't know what's going on now, but it sure needed a little cleaning up, I'd say.
Okay. Sterling, if I might take a turn here briefly, let me just comment that these letters said that the men could not go to priesthood meeting anymore, right?
But they that's right.
Go. Of course, that's the way women have had it all along, isn't it?
That's right.
Anyhow, let's
well,
turn
you,
to...
Well, you see, that is a lowering men to the level of women. That's getting pretty rough.
That's true. That's true. Women are the lowest level participants in the organization. All right, turning to influences in your life, though, you and Natalie are just an amazing couple. I mean, everyone who knows you, I mean, they just never fight. They're so sweet together. They're just such a joy to be with. What is your... And I wish, you know, she would not be interviewed. I mean, it is so neat, her comments back and forth. It's really...
I hope she's here.
She is. What y'all been married 56 years.
That's right.
In June. What's the secret of a long and happy marriage?
Well, it's just living the way the church tells you to live. Now, I being the dominant male, hold the priesthood. And we have that understanding in accordance with the basic principles that she can make decisions in all the little things. I'll make the decisions in the big things. You know, little things like, shall we buy a new car? That's her decision. Shall we go on a vacation? And where shall we go? That's her decision. Shall we paint the house? Or plan to sell it? That's her decision. Now, of course, the big decisions are mine. Now, this is the secret of getting along well for 56 years. The big decisions are mine. I made the decision as to whether we should admit China to the United Nations. Well, that's the way it's set up, you know. That's the whole idea, I think, of the priesthood. And
would you mind sharing with us about when you and Natalie first met, or when you first saw her?
Oh, when I first saw her, I almost swooned. I was on a stairway at the university in what was called the L building. It's now the mathematics building, I guess. I was going down the stairway. It's when I was a student. And she was coming up. She swears she didn't see me, but I saw her, and I knew I had known her in the pre-existence. I knew she was meant for me. And we had our first date on June 8th, 1935. We had a whirlwind courtship. 3 years later to the day, I married her.
And she converted to the church, right?
Oh, well, of course. Heavens, you wouldn't expect me to marry a non-Mormon, would you? Well, Natalie came from a half-Mormon family. Her father was a Jack Mormon, and her mother was a Campbellite. But her mother joined the church. Not as a result of us, but as a result of one of Natalie's brothers and his wife. They converted her in her later years. She was very happy in the church. Church can bring a great deal of happiness to people. And that's the best thing about the church. That's the only point in having a church, as a matter of fact, is to bring some kind of happiness to people.
Sterling, you've had some wonderful friends in the church throughout all these years, one of the oldest of which is Lowell Binion. Would you like to share about your relationship with Lowell? And didn't you buy his car one time?
I sure did. $40. It's a 26 Oldsmobile. And it shimmied, and he warned me, don't go over 34 miles an hour or the thing will shake to pieces. And I went over 34 miles an hour, and it did shake to pieces. Had to take it to a garage, needed a universal joint. It cost me $5. Lowell had never had it fixed. Well, I have quite a few friends now, I think, but I haven't had very many friends. And the oldest friend in terms of the time span is a friend of mine from childhood who lives in Provo. Some of you may know him. Charles Peterson, Chuck Peterson, they call him. But Lowell Durham, not Lowell Durham, Lowell Binion. Lowell Binion is the oldest friend that I have of a continuous friendship except for Peterson from my childhood. I met Lowell Binion when he started to do the institute work at the University of Utah, and he did classes at the University Ward. I didn't take any of his classes. I'm sorry I didn't. I didn't take his classes, but I met him, and we became very good friends. Now, that would have been, I think, in 1936. And later, the same year, the next year, I gained two other friends. His brother Lynn Binion, and Obert Tanner. Now, they are the three oldest friends that I have. That is, not in terms of age, but in terms of the time that we have had a lasting friendship. Of course, Obert died just a year ago. But Lowell is a wonderful person, all three of them marvelous human beings. Lowell is a wonderful person. It should have been an apostle. I mean, I've never been consulted about who should be appointed as apostle. I wish they would consult me sometime. I would have had Lowell as an apostle, and I would have had Marion D. Hanks as an apostle. I told Duff Hanks that about a year or two ago. Well, he says that makes two votes for us. But I would say we have a couple of new apostles now, and I think they're an excellent choice, both of them, Jeff Holland and Brother Hales. I think they're... you're talking about who should be appointed an apostle. You have to think in terms of the reservoir of people who are potential apostles, you know. I mean, you can't go out and just get anybody. There's a limited group that you might think might conceivably be in the picture. And as I say, though I wasn't consulted on it, I certainly would vote for both of these new apostles and the new president of the church, Brother Hunter. It's too bad he didn't become president some years ago. But I think he's a wonderful person, a very, very decent, genteel human being.
Do you want to share with us about when you and Natalie first met with Brother and Sister Hunter?
Oh, yes. Well, Natalie wasn't there. I was a house guest of Brother Hunter's some years ago. Brother and Sister Hunter, his wife died. I think he remarried President Hunter. They were building a home up not far from us, and we used to go through all these houses just before they were finished and take a look at them. And Natalie said, if you want to see that home of Apostle Hunter's, you better get over there and go through it. So I stopped on a Saturday morning and went around and went in the lower floor. It was on a hill. The door was unlocked, and I went in and looked around. It was a very nice place, beautiful place, recreation room and the stairway. I went up the stairway and walked in on them having breakfast in their nightgowns. Anyway, I got acquainted with them. They're lovely. They invited me to breakfast and showed me through the house, and he was in his pajamas. She had a bathrobe or something on, or whatever women call those things. They're wonderful people, I thought.
Okay. Sterling, taking another turn here.
He hasn't invited me back, incidentally.
Taking another turn here. You were appointed to the Kennedy administration as Commissioner of Education. You're not a political person. How did that appointment come about?
Well, I've often wondered. Actually, I got a call a couple of nights before President Kennedy was inaugurated from Al Urich. He was vice president of the Ford Foundation. And he told me that President Kennedy had asked him, and I think some others, if they would propose somebody to be Commissioner of Education. And they had a meeting. I don't know who all was there. John Gardner, president of the Carnegie Corporation, was one, and Urich, vice president of the Ford Foundation. Anyway, they wanted to propose me, and he wanted to know if I'd take the job. You know, I didn't know there was such a thing as a commissioner of education. I should have known that, but I really didn't. But I thought, well, it's a proper thing to do if the president wants me, and so they appointed me. They didn't. Beyond that, I was never asked if I'd take the job. I went to Washington, and they just said the president will make the announcement this afternoon. And that was that. I found that I had one very important qualification. I didn't know it at the time, but I heard a telephone conversation with the president where they said he doesn't belong to the NEA. That's the National Education Association. And I later was told that President Kennedy, I think that's why they appointed me. They were looking for somebody who didn't belong to the NEA. I was later told that President Kennedy was determined to not appoint anyone who belonged to the NEA, which was then very conservative, very conservative. operation.
Sterling, what did President Kennedy think of Utah? What did he think of Mormons?
Well, he didn't ever tell me what he thought of Mormons. But he did say, you know, I was with him in the Oval Office one day when he said, you know, the people of Utah didn't vote for me. And he brought it up, I didn't. Well, I said, I know they didn't, but I said, you know, you're really very popular out there. They like you anyway. I don't know whether that was true or not. But it was certainly the proper thing to say. On occasion, there were occasions he asked me, for instance, once to extend his regards to President McKay and also to one or two other leading figures in the church among the apostles. The other two, I know, were both Democrats. But I didn't ever discuss Mormonism with him, though he knew I was a Mormon. No question about that. He knew that.
Did the church come up in your Senate confirmation?
The church?
Or your being a Mormon, was that raised in, when you were confirmed by the
Well,
Senate?
As a matter of fact, just one thing. In the hearing before the Senate committee, Senator Clark, I think it was, of Pennsylvania, a person of real stature, said that, I understand that you are a Mormon, and I said yes, and he said, now, you understand this was way back in 1961, early in 1961. He said, in view of the fact that you're a Mormon, what would be your stand on such things as the integration of the schools? Because that was becoming a major issue then. And I simply said to him, this is all published, the Congress published these things, and the statement's all published. I said, I simply don't agree with the Mormon Church on its policy with respect to the Negroes. We call them Negroes in those days, you know, with respect to the Negroes. And I said, I've made this very clear to the leading officials of the Mormon Church, and they know that I disagree with them. And I can fully support and will work for the integration of the schools. That was the end of that. There was no other reference to my being a Mormon in the confirmation. I used to get introduced a good deal as a Mormon. I remember Abraham Ribicoff introducing me once to a large group of university presidents, and he said, one thing that I'm pleased with is that he's not from the East, he's not from Harvard, and he's a Mormon. That was a little embarrassing to me. So. But and the president of Harvard was there, but we got along fine. They were getting so many people from Harvard in the Kennedy administration. Was the reason he made that comment, you know.
Sterling, while you were in Washington, you were, of course, took many educational initiatives on a number of things. What is the most lasting thing you did while serving in that capacity?
Well, from the standpoint of legislation, we made some breakthroughs and laid the foundation for breakthroughs in the federal government furnishing funds to various areas of education. Now, from the standpoint of legislation, that was the important thing. But even more important in some ways, I think I managed to make it clear that the United States Office of Education, now the Department of Education, was not a function of the NEA. And in all, it's not unfair to say that to a considerable extent it had been, that the NEA was pretty well controlling what went on there. That, I think, is a major development. And the other thing that I would be willing to mention is that I made it clear that I felt that my function was to be a critic of the schools and the people at the and the educational organizations, not for higher education. I had no problem with them, but for lower education, they felt that my only function was to try to get federal money for them. That was the function. And it's almost unbelievable, some of the things that actually occurred. It would take too long to tell you as to how they assumed that the Commissioner of Education, or now the Secretary of Education, should just keep his damn mouth shut about what goes on in the schools unless he could praise them. That was the attitude of many of the leaders. Not all of them, you understand. There's one from Utah who was highly placed in the NEA, who was a man of real stature. But I'm referring to Alan West, whom some of you would know. He didn't fit that pattern at all. But the idea that anyone should be critical of the public schools or even the private schools of America was anathema to them. It was hard for me to believe. And they were very much opposed to me. They were opposed to me because I believed in merit pay for teachers, because I believed that teachers should be thoroughly educated in the subject which they taught, and so on. I mean, I think they got $10 or something from every member, and by gosh, $10 from the worst teacher in the country was just as good as $10 as from the best teacher. Anyway, I shouldn't dwell on that. You understand, I got along with them fine. They didn't like me, and I didn't like some of them. But we were gentlemen about it, you know, most of the time.
Sterling, while you were in that capacity and sense, I mean, but you made a lot of speeches. I remember as your student that I always took notes, and you never read from notes. That you come into class and lecture for several hours without referring to a note. But you were in Washington, D.C., and you were making speeches all over. And isn't there an interesting story about the White House and clearing your speeches and stuff? Could you share that?
Yeah, well, this note business has got me into trouble more than once. I don't use notes because I don't have any. I mean, you got to have notes if you're going to use notes. I don't have any notes. A student at the University of Utah came to me one day, and about the second week of the class, he was an advanced student in the law school. And he said, "Do you want my criticism of you now or at the end of the course?" And I said, "Well, we just as well have it now." "Well," he said, "you're not prepared." I said, "Now what's your evidence that I'm not prepared?" And he said, "You don't have any notes." That took care of that. He didn't show up again. After he gave me that broadside, he quit the class. When I started teaching at the University of started teaching at the University of Southern California in the School of Philosophy, when I was put on the faculty, I was immediately put on a course that had three of my former teachers on it. And it was one of these big affairs, you know, like we used to have after the war, several hundred students. They come to lectures and then go to discussion sections and so on. And the requirement was that we take turns giving the lectures, and that each person, faculty person, attend the other person's lectures. That was a part of the requirement. And it was a nice arrangement. There were these teachers of mine, you know, there was a pulpit thing like this, and they had their notes and so on, and I thought, my hell, what am I going to do? When it comes my turn, I don't have any notes. And this concerned me a great deal. It really did. And I finally hit upon a wonderful solution. I just got a manila folder with a lot of blank yellow pages, and I would turn them from time to time and look down, and they didn't know the difference. So I got by with it. Well, this thing that Laurie mentions, it was not long after I became Commissioner of Education. I was going up to Harvard to deliver a lecture, and formal lectures, I preferred to write them, you know. They brought me a man who was to be my speechwriter. He had been my predecessor's speechwriter. I said, I'm going to write my own speeches. They couldn't believe that. But I said, you have to find something else. He was a nice person. You have to find something else for him to do. I'm not going to have him writing speeches for me. And I never did have anybody do that. Well, I did let him write. I was supposed to dealing with his subordinates. Heber C. Snell, who was the church's best Bible scholar in his day by far, and had retired, and he was 80 years old, and he had retired. And this man had worked for the church all his life, and I mean all his life. He had worked for the church. He had been a principal of the Bighorn Academy in the days of academies, taught at Snow College when it was a church school, at the BYU, and then went in the institutes and now had retired. I don't know that he ever had a job except working for the church, and a man of great piety, honest to goodness piety. And he received word that he was to be hauled up for excommunication, for an excommunication trial. And I have the documents. He got in touch with me and Obert Tanner. We were both friends of his. Obert was already trying to save a guy from excommunication down in Utah County, so we decided that I would take Snell's case, and because Obert had his hands full trying to save a card-carrying communist from being excommunicated. And he saved him, as a matter of fact. Well, I went to see President Hugh B. Brown, a man of great stature. Those of you who didn't know President Brown were denied something. And President Brown, I said to President Brown, you know, we don't execute. We don't excommunicate heretics and so on. Snell's a heretic, but a devoted man, devoted to the church, and a genuinely pious religious person, 80 years old. And President Brown was 80 years old. And he called the stake president on the phone. The stake president was up in Logan. Snell lived in Logan. The stake president was a mortician in Logan. And President Brown really went at him. Now, he said, this document, I had the document, says that he is being charged with apostasy and wrongdoing. That's what he was being charged with. And all of those that I have say apostasy and wrongdoing. Now, he said, you haven't indicated here what he has done wrong or what he has said or written or done that constitutes apostasy. Well, the man said, well, I'm doing it the way that he held the receiver so we could both hear what was going on. It's in his office at 47 East South. And incidentally, President Brown finally told me one day, after this, when we get together, we better do it at home. and not here in my office. So after that, we met at his home. Anyway, the fellow said, well, that's the way you're supposed to do it. President Brown, you know, was a lawyer. He said, you have to lay out a bill of particulars of what he has done that is wrong, for wrongdoing, and what he has said or written that constitutes apostasy. And he said, now I'm going to be out of the country for a while, and I don't want anything to be done on this while I'm away. Then President Brown turned to me and he said, you know, he has no stomach for this. This will be the end of it. It's being engineered from this building, is what he told me. And he said, this state president has no stomach for it. Well, so he said, that'll be the end of it. I told Snell that would be the end of it. And you know, several months later, by damn, he got another letter from the same state president with a bill of particulars. Apostasy and wrongdoing and a bill of particulars. I wish I'd brought it with me. I'd like to read it, but I shouldn't. It's you know, this is very confidential stuff. You mustn't tell about these things. It said, here's the bill of particulars. He said, you are reputed to have said, it didn't say that he said it, it has been reported that you have said that you don't know whether God is black or white. That was the first charge. I called Snell up on the phone. He was in Logan. I said, Heber, when I first got this, I said, it says here that you are reputed to have said that you don't know whether God is black or white. Well, he said, I don't know. I said, did you say that? Well, I don't know. It's the kind of thing I might have said. Well, I guess if they said I said it, I suppose I did. Well, I said, now, Heber, you've been in this church for 80 years, and if you don't know whether God is black or white, you ought to be thrown out on your damn head. Well, you know, he tried to laugh, but he couldn't. He couldn't laugh. Well, another of them was, I have always had certain questions about the Book of Mormon. They were all of that type. Well, President Brown, and I showed it to him, he and I sat there and laughed and had a good time over this. And he said, well, I'll just take this to the top. The top was President McKay. And the next morning, very early, he called me. President McKay, you know, got up very, very early. He got up very early. And President Brown called me early. He said, I just came. He was very careful what he said on the phone from his own office. He said, I just came from a meeting with our mutual friend. And he said, to tell you that we do not do this sort of thing in this church. And that's that. And President Brown said, and that's that. And that was that. Snell didn't hear any more about it. We have some marvelous people in the leadership of the church. I don't know how many of you knew Levi Edgar Young. Delightful person. And J. Golden Kimball. They were both presidents of the First Council of the 70, you know. J. Golden Kimball was the senior after B.H. Roberts died. And J. Golden was a tall, thin man, and Levi Edgar Young was short and rather delicate and very genteel, a very, very genteel person. I just have to tell you this. My mother was in town once from Los Angeles, and for something she had to see President Levi Edgar Young. So we went up to their offices in the church office building at 47 East South Temple, and Levi Edgar wasn't in his office. And as we came back, Jay Golden, his door was open, and Jay Golden Kimball saw us, and he came out, and he knew my mother, and he said, can I be of any help? You know, he had a high, shrill, monotone voice. Some of you older people would Well, I said we were looking for President Levi Edgar Young, and he said, "That little shrimp." Now, that kind of humor has kind of gone out of the church. I don't think the general authorities talk about each other that way nowadays. We better quit, Evan.
Yes, our time is up. Sterling, this has been wonderful. Thank you very much for this and for all you've done for the church.
And thank you for joining us for this final broadcast session of the 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium. We've been listening to an interview with Sterling M. McMurrin, who is the E.E. Erickson Professor of Philosophy Emeritus at the University of Utah and a former Education Commissioner under John F. Kennedy and Director of the Tanner Lectures on Human Values and author of several books on Mormon philosophy. The interviewer in the session was Laurie DePadova, and we heard some stories that perhaps many Mormons have never encountered before, and McMurrin speaks in a pretty unrestrained style. The tapes of all the sessions you've heard today on the broadcast and other sessions that you may not have heard are available for purchase on cassette, and you can call 355-5926, that's the Sunstone office, or while we're still at the Hilton, you can call 532-3344, and we can send you more information about that. Sunstone would like to thank KCPW and Clay Anderson Audio for their help in bringing you this broadcast of the 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, and we'd also like to thank our underwriters for their support. Next year, the Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium will be held the 9th to 12th of August, again here at the Salt Lake Hilton. And we hope that you'll join us here and on the air as well. Until then, we thank you for tuning in, and we will return now to the studios of KCPW.